Okay, so some very interesting points being made just here in this word for word about how Brahma was astonished seeing Agasura, the whole pastime that took place with Agasura, and he was sort of thinking to himself, could this really be the Supreme Lord? He wasn't sure, so he thought, okay, I'll test him out to see, and we'll see what evolves here as this chapter continues. O Maharaj Parikshit, Brahma, who resides in the higher planetary system in the sky, had observed the activities of the most powerful Krishna in killing and delivering Agasura, and he was astonished. Now that same Brahma wanted to show some of his own power and see the power of Krishna, who was engaged in his childhood pastimes, playing as if with ordinary cowherd boys. Therefore, in Krishna's absence, Brahma took all the boys and calves to another place. Thus he became entangled, for in the very near future he would see how powerful Krishna was. So, this, I'll read the purport in a moment, but this pastime we see here is another extraordinary manifestation of Krishna's Leela Shakti, where Krishna's just performed this most amazing pastime, where he's delivered Agasura. But what happened in that pastime, we see this described in the previous chapters, how when the cowherd boys, they saw this, what appeared to be a cave, the mouth of Agasura was open, it was so vast, and it's described how it was reaching up to the clouds, and they thought it was a cave, but then they started to think, well, but it smells, it's a really bad fishy smell coming out of this cave, or maybe it's a big demon in the form of a snake who's come here to eat us all. And they said, oh, whatever, it doesn't matter. Krishna will save us. And so they just walked into the mouth of the demon. And it describes there how Krishna became bewildered when he saw this. He was stunned momentarily. He was looking at this and thought, you know, he was stunned. And some persons who see this pastime and read about it, They think that Krishna's an ordinary person because he became stunned, he became bewildered. It's almost like he didn't know what to do. But it's described by Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur that actually what was happening is that Krishna was marveling at the way his potencies work, how the Leela Shakti works to create these amazing pastimes, where the cowherd boys, just under the influence of his yoga maya, will enter into the mouth of this demon for certain doom. But certainly, you know, to peril the poison, because the poison coming from the mouth of Agasura was so powerful that the smell was very, very strong. Yet they knew that Krishna would save them. They had such conviction that Krishna would save them. And Brahma, who was hiding in the sky, he witnessed this. And he was reflecting, he was thinking, could this really be the Supreme Personality of Godhead? He wasn't sure. But he was pretty astonished because of what Krishna had done, you know, because he entered into the mouth of Agasura and then just expanded himself beyond belief and just killed this demon. And then he brought all the cowherd boys back to life and the cows brought them all back to life just by glancing over them. So he was seeing a small display of the potency of Krishna. Just as Krishna says, you should know that all these glorious, wonderful, and beautiful creations, they spring from but a spark of my splendor. And if we look around this material world and we see the power of this material nature, the power of the wind, the power of fire, the power of water. You know, sometimes in certain parts of the world they have waves that are taller than 50 feet high, crashing on the shore. Or if you go out in the ocean, sometimes the waves are even bigger than that. And they can just, you know, destroy these big ocean-going ships just with one wave. Or the power of fire. And when they have these, we just recently saw the power of fire here in London. You know, in a very quick time, it just completely destroyed a building. And that's not even, you know, a very powerful manifestation of fire, but very, very powerful. And these things, as powerful as they may be, are just a small, tiny, infinitesimal manifestation of Krishna's energy. And so here, he's demonstrating his pastimes. Very small manifestation of Krishna's energy. And then after that, then Krishna gathers up the cowherd boys and he says to them, well, it's getting late, so let's sit down and have our lunch. You know? And so they find this very, very pleasing spot on the bank of the Jamuna, and it describes how the birds and the bees, they're enjoying the sweet fragrance of the lotus, and the bees are entering the lotus. They're saying such a pleasing sound, you know, it's emanating, you know, it's echoing throughout the forest. Let's sit down here, and it's a nice beach, and there's beautiful water. The calves, they can drink the water from the Jamuna. And so they let the calves drink the water from the Jamuna, and then they tie them up so they don't wander off. Somehow or other, they do wander off. The ropes become loose and they manage to wander off. And they sit down and they have their lunch. There's this beautiful description there of how Krishna, he's holding in his hand a mixture of yogurt and rice. And then Brahma's seeing this and he's starting to reflect, but he's just like an ordinary person. He's just doing the same things as anyone else does. And then he starts to steal from his friends. He steals their remnants. And that's too much for Brahma. He can't believe that this isn't God. This is not my God. Because Brahma has a very different concept of God. His concept of God is Aishwarya, where he's seeing God that, you know, he's this supreme person in Vaikuntha, and he's Narayan, and everyone bows down to him. Not that he's eating the remnants of these other people. You know? So he's seeing this, and this, you know, he becomes completely bewildered. And then he thinks, now I'm going to test this person out to see if he really is God. And it describes how he becomes influenced by the Lord's Maya potency, and he becomes bewildered. And then he wants to steal the calves and the cowherd boys to test Krishna out, to see really, is this God? And so he does that. And it describes here, in this verse, it says, I think the word is Maya Baksha, where it's mentioning how the Baksha, the boys, were actually made of Krishna's Maya. They weren't actually the original cowherd boys that Brahma stole. It's very similar to the pastime of when Ravana tried to steal Sita. You know, he was actually thinking he was stealing Sita, but Krishna, Ram, by his potency, created this Maya Sita. And it's so seamless is Krishna's, the way is Krishna's energies work. And we see in the material body, you know, we're not this body. Yet the whole workings of the material nature is so seamless, we can't determine, at least in the beginning stages of bhakti, we can't see the difference between the body, the senses, the mind. It all seems like, in the intelligence and the soul, it all seems like one unit to us. But there's separate things functioning there. But the seamless nature of Krishna's energy is you don't see that. And so, in the same way, when Brahma stole the calves and the cowherd boys, he stole the calves first and then he stole the cowherd boys, he didn't notice this transition at all. That how Krishna manifested the cowherd boys from his Maya, Mahamaya potency. And then we see as it evolves how he, when he stole all the calves and cowherd boys, Krishna, by his own arrangement, manifested, expanded himself and manifested all the calves, all the cowherd boys, all identical in a moment. Just like nothing had happened. And then, so Brahma takes them all and he hides them away. And he's thinking, now I will see the power of this person. Now I will see. Because he's trying to demonstrate his own power. But it describes here how he couldn't actually use his power against Krishna's friends. He could only use it to try to show Krishna something. But actually, he was embarrassed in the end because he was thinking he was so powerful and he was able to do so many things. But then Krishna manifested himself perfectly as the calves and the cowherd boys, so perfectly that even Lord Balaram, because actually this day that this happened, because you can imagine if Lord Brahma had tried to steal Balaram, what would happen? Now, he could probably get himself into a lot of hot water there. But so this day that this occurred was actually Balaram Purnim. It was Balaram's birthday. So Balaram wasn't there. He was at home, and traditionally on the birthday they do it like we do Abhishek. This is coming from Vedic culture. And so they would have this bathing ceremony on the birthday. You can see on the front of, maybe it's on the front of this, they don't have the cover here, but on the front of one of the Bhagavatams, actually it's probably the previous canto. Oh no, it's this one here, where you see the appearance of Krishna, and they've got him in this gold bowl, and there's a nice garland overhead, and all the cowherd ladies are around bathing Krishna. So that's Krishna's birthday. That's one of the functions they do on a birthday in Vedic culture, and that's where we get it from. So Balaram wasn't there on this day, he was at home. And when Brahma, he stole the calves and the cowherd boys. And then 1 year later, we see that Balaram is starting to appreciate, you know, I've noticed over the last year that the affection of the cowherd men, the cowherd ladies, and the cows for their own children is just like their affection for Krishna. What's going on here? Yeah. And then he started to reflect, well, maybe this is the demigods, they're doing something, or maybe some, maybe Narad Muni's expanded into the calves and the other sages and things like that. He says, no, they couldn't do this. Only my lord and master could do this to me. Only he can put me into illusion. So then he asked Krishna what had happened, and Krishna explained exactly what had happened. And it's explained later on how the Krishna actually did this for the pleasure of Brahma and for the pleasure of the residents of Vrindavan, because we see that the dominant feature in all these pastimes that take place in Vrindavan is Krishna does these things simply to please the devotees and simply to increase the devotees' affection for him. In all the different pastimes, even like his childhood pastimes, and as he gets older, you know, especially the pastimes in Vrindavan, we see that the dominant feature in all these pastimes is how Krishna is acting to nurture and to foster the love the devotees have for him. And we see this is constantly increasing. And this will become very evident in this pastime also, because we see later on, 1 year later after this takes place, that's towards the end of this chapter, I think, that the cowherd men, they're up on top of Govardhan Hill, and the cows, they see the calves down the bottom of Govardhan Hill, and they run down the hill. You know, they've got their tails and their heads up in the air, and their udders are full of milk, and they just run down the hill, and they start to lick the calves. And it describes there how they're licking them like they're trying to swallow them. They become so, overwhelmed by love and affection for the calves that they just couldn't stop themselves. And then the cowherd men, they're trying to stop the cows from running down the hill, and they come running down the hill, and they're feeling angry with themselves and upset because they couldn't stop it. And then their boys are there, those persons they're thinking are their boys are there, and they become overwhelmed with love for them, and they pick them up and sit them on their laps, and they start smelling their hair and their head and stroking them and stuff. And they also became overwhelmed. And then Balaram, he saw this, and he thought, this is not, there's something different going on here. And then he understood what was happening, and he asked Krishna, he said, please explain this to me in a very shorthand way so I can understand what's happening. And so we see how Krishna, through his Lila Shakti, his pastime potency, is performing so many wonderful activities to increase the love the devotees have for him. So I'll read Srila Prabhupada's purport. When Agasura was being killed by Krishna, who was accompanied by his associates, Brahma was astonished. But when he saw that Krishna was very much enjoying his pastimes of lunch, he was even more astonished and wanted to test whether Krishna was actually there. He saw him, and just the exchange, Krishna's stealing, you know, the cowherd boys are stealing things from Krishna's plate and eating it, and Krishna's stealing things from their plate. He's saying, this can't be God. This is just some powerful person. Let me test him to see if this is Krishna or not. And so Krishna's Yogamaya, maybe it was Mahamaya, but probably Yogamaya potency was covering him over, and he couldn't actually understand. Thus he became entangled in Krishna's Maya. After all, Brahma was born materially, as mentioned here, Ambojanma Jani. He was born of Amboja, a lotus flower. It does not matter that he was born of a lotus and not of any man, animal, or material father. A lotus is also material, and anyone born through the material energy must be subject to the four material deficiencies: Brahma, the tendency to commit mistakes; Pramada, the tendency to be illusioned; Vipralipsa, the tendency to cheat; and Karanapatava, imperfect senses. Thus Brahma also became entangled. Brahma, with his Maya, wanted to test whether Krishna was actually present. These cowherd boys were but expansions of Krishna's personal self, Ananda Chinmayadasa Pratipavitabir. Later, Krishna would show Brahma how he expands himself into everything as his personal pleasure, Ananda Chinmayadas, Tladini Shakti Asmat. Krishna has a transcendental potency called Tladini Shakti. He does not enjoy anything He does not enjoy anything that is a product of the material energy. Brahma, therefore, would see Lord Krishna expand his energy. So Krishna's only enjoying through his Tladini Shakti, through his internal potency. He's enjoying material nature. Whereas the conditioned living entity is trying, you know, hope against hope, trying to enjoy the material nature, but constantly meeting with frustration. But we see here Krishna, he's not engaging with the material energy, he's actually engaging with his internal potency. And the cowherd boys are all expansions of Krishna's internal potency. And so for Brahma to steal the cowherd boys was actually an impossible task because they're Krishna's internal potency. How can he do that? Brahma, as is being pointed out here, is a conditioned living entity. And he's born of the material nature. So he cannot actually, you know, the same as Ravan, he tried to steal Krishna's internal potency. He can't do that. It's not possible because he's a materially conditioned living entity. So in the same way, Brahma, even though he tried to steal, and you know, Krishna's Lila Shakti made the arrangement where he actually thought this was happening. It deluded him into thinking that he was doing this. But as the pastime evolves, we understand that actually he didn't do this. He was only interacting with the Lord's external energy. So in this way, we can understand he's influenced by Maha Maya. Brahma wanted to take away Krishna's associates, but instead he took away some other boys and calves. Ravana wanted to take away Sita, but that was impossible. And instead he took away a Maya Sita. Similarly, Brahma took away Maya Bhaka, boys manifested by Krishna's Maya. Brahma could show some extraordinary opulence to the Maya Bhaka, but he could not show any extraordinary opulence to Krishna's associates because Krishna removed his potency, withdrew his potency, so that Brahma could not demonstrate any power. That he would see in the very near future. Maya Bhakasha Ishitu. This bewilderment, this Maya, was caused by the Supreme Controller, Prabhavatar, the all-potent Supreme Person, Krishna, and we shall see the result. Anyone materially born is subject to bewilderment. This pastime is therefore called Brahma Vimohana Lila, the pastime of bewildering Brahma. Mohitam Nabijananti Mamebhyam Param Avyayam, Bhagavad Gita 7.13. Materially born persons cannot fully understand Krishna. Even the demigods cannot understand him. Muyanti Yat Suraya, Tena Brahma Hridaya Adikavaye, Bhagavatam 111. Everyone from Brahma down to the smallest insect must take lessons from Krishna. So we see here this in this pastime, it's kind of like the epitome of one in the material energy, is trying to control, is trying to enjoy, but is constantly being frustrated. So Brahma, he's thinking, you know, foolishly thinking that, well, I don't think this is Krishna, I don't think this is the Supreme Person, this is just some powerful person, but I'll show him how powerful I am. And, you know, steal all his friends. And let him try and do something about that. And he'll be just wandering around on his own looking for his friends. Where are my friends? Where are my calves? But little did he know the potency of Krishna. And as I was saying before, you know, Krishna was just manifesting a small portion of his potency. Because we see, you know, is this beautiful painting on the wall here about the creation and how, you know, so much the universe is expanded in so many different ways. And it's all coming from just a simple thought process of Krishna. Krishna's not even directly involved in the creation of the material universe. And he expands himself as Balaram, who then expands as Mahashankarshan, who expands as the first Chatavyuha and the second Chatavyuha, then the Purusha avatars, and all these different forms are expanding, just coming from this original thought process of Krishna. And the whole universe is created, you know, through Krishna's potency. Yet he's not extending any energy himself. But we see here in this material world, how, you know, when people are trying to create things, make buildings or make cars or whatever it is they're making, they have to extend so much energy, work very, very hard for a long period of time. Just like, you know, staying in central London with Merlin, and every day when we walk to the temple, going past all these buildings that have been going up, you know, there's one building there they've been putting up for several years now. And there's every day there's hundreds of men there and doing, you know, working and digging holes and driving machines and banging things and cutting things, and, you know, so much endeavor they're going through, and, you know, they're banging things and they're hitting their thumbs with a hammer and all that sort of stuff, and you know, swearing and carrying on, and it takes them years and years and years of very concentrated and focused endeavor to make a simple thing like a building. Yet Krishna, just through a simple thought process, has created the entire material universe. And it wasn't much effort for him at all. So the living entities are thinking, you know, foolishly thinking, you know, if they even come to the point of accepting there is a God, which is in this day and age is becoming more and more rare. Most people are thinking either there is no God, I'm God, you know, it's just an illusion, it's just, you know, he may be a powerful personality, and you know, we see the demons, they think they can kill God. So many people have, most people have this wrong idea about the existence of Krishna and about his potency. Whereas we see here, it's describing even Brahma, you know, who's the greatest person in this material universe, the most powerful person in this material universe, is not sure whether or not this cowherd boy was Krishna. So even a great personality like that can also be easily bewildered by Krishna's maya potency. Easily. Krishna doesn't even have to try. Even Balaram, who is he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself, was bewildered by Krishna's yoga maya potency. Because he's God himself, it didn't take him long to figure it out. You know, once he started to reflect on what's going on here, then he figured it out very quickly. So we see that, you know, a living entity in this material world, they're trying to enjoy themselves separately from Krishna, and they're meeting with frustration constantly. And it's only when one can actually come to understand the nature of Krishna, it's only when one comes to understand that Krishna is the supreme controller, Krishna is the supreme enjoyer. This is mentioned in the fifth chapter of the Gita. Then one actually knows peace in this world. But as long as the living entities are trying to enjoy this material world separate from Krishna, they're always going to meet with frustration. And this is what's happening with Brahma also. He's thinking that he's controlling this situation. He's thinking he's the enjoyer here. He steals the calves and the cowherd boys, comes back a moment later and says, what's going on here? It's just as it was, you know, when I left. So what's going on? And he becomes very, very bewildered. He becomes disturbed. And then Krishna reveals to him, he manifests all these Vishnu forms. He manifests, shows how all the calves and the cowherd boys, the Vishnu forms. And surprisingly or amazingly, what he does is when Krishna manifests these Vishnu forms, then also he shows how all the vibhutis, the different energies, the material energy and all gathered around worshipping these Vishnu forms. And then Brahma sees himself there also, worshipping these Vishnu forms. It must be a very bewildering thing where he's standing there and he sees himself worshipping Krishna or worshipping these Vishnu forms. And then he just becomes completely bewildered and describes how he passes out. And then when he comes to, he sees everything back as it was, all the calves and cowherd boys returned. And then he understood what had happened, how Krishna had expanded himself like this. Just to demonstrate to Brahma his real position, that actually he was just a servant of Krishna, and how Krishna, by his inconceivable potencies, he can do so many amazing pastimes, and the jiva cannot understand it because the jiva is so limited and Krishna is so vast. He cannot understand how Krishna manifests himself in so many different ways and can even enjoy as a cowherd boy, how Krishna finds that enjoyable. Because, you know, if people have a concept of God, generally it's God the Almighty or God the All-Powerful. You know, we see, you know, in more primitive cultures, and they'll worship, you know, nature spirits, they'll worship trees or mountains or volcanoes or the wind or some great power in nature, because they can identify with this, because this is greater, this is more powerful than me. And God has to be more powerful than me. Otherwise, how can he be God? Because if I'm more powerful than God, that makes me God. And so the living entity become bewildered. If they see Krishna manifesting pastimes like this, they become bewildered. They can't understand. How is it that God can manifest himself as a small boy and just enjoy these regular pastimes? How is it he's playing in the dust of Vrindavan? How is it his mother Yasoda can chastise him and tie him up? They can't understand this, because they have this concept where God must be more powerful than me. But the reality is God is more powerful, but he's just choosing to manifest like this, because it's described by our acharyas how Krishna manifests himself in so many different ways. Sometimes he'll manifest himself in this Aishwarya feature as the Supreme Lord, where he's controlling and ruling everything. But that's not, and then everyone comes, they bow down before him and all this sort of stuff. But they're all dependent upon Krishna to provide them with all their needs and protect them and things like that. And that's okay, and Krishna, he does that. But he actually, more than that, that sort of exchange, he actually prefers the exchange where he's the one who's dependent upon his devotee, where he's the one who's being protected by his mother and father, where he's the one who's dependent upon them for food. He doesn't have to worry about anything. He just depends upon his devotee. And so he actually prefers this more than taking the role of being God the Supreme Controller and the Enjoyer. He just prefers to have fun with his devotees, to just play with his devotees in the forest of Vrindavan. And no one has the concept that he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He finds this much more pleasing than when people are bowing down to him and, oh, you're the Supreme Lord, you're this, you're that. He finds it much more pleasing where he can just be himself and just play with his friends. So when a conditioned living entity sees this, and Brahma, as Prabhupada's pointing out here, because the words used here indicating that he's born from a material situation, this is indicating that he's actually under the influence of the basic defects that every material living entity have. Therefore, when he sees these extraordinary pastimes of Krishna, he becomes bewildered. Because he's in this situation where he has imperfect senses, he's put into illusion, he's cheating. He can't actually see things as they are. It's only by Krishna's mercy. And he sees that later on, that, it's by Krishna's mercy I've understood this, and then he submits himself to Krishna. Same thing was happening in the Gita with Arjuna. Arjuna was just thinking Krishna was his friend. He kind of had, some idea, okay, yeah, he is God. But he's still my friend, so he thought he was the same. But then when Krishna manifests, we see in the 10th chapter of the Gita, when Krishna manifests his universal form and he sees, the whole universe, he sees all the warriors on the battlefield entering into Krishna's mouth and being crushed by Krishna's the teeth of the universal form, he sees, everything going on. Then he really appreciates who Krishna is and how powerful he is. Then he submits himself to Krishna. Completely, wholly. He really takes it to heart. So we see the same thing was happening here with Brahma, is that once he understood who he was trying to fool, who he was trying to play with, then he became very concerned about what he'd done. And he bowed down before Krishna. And of course, Krishna, he didn't take offense with it. He didn't get upset with Brahma. I was reading, in the 8th chapter of the 4th canto, Prabhupada talks about that, how actually Narada was saying to Dhruva how Krishna is always kind to the devotees. He always has this favorable disposition. And even if devotees do something foolish or wrong, he's very, very kind to them. He's always looking for the welfare and looking out for the best for devotees. And so we see that even though Brahma had stolen the calves and the cowherd boys, that Krishna didn't become angry with him. He was very compassionate to him, and he just showed his potency to him. But then he said, everything was okay. And it's kind of interesting that in the end of that section in the the 4th canto, the 8th chapter, that was it there or something? No, it was later on. Given so many classrooms, so many different sections lately of the Bhagavatam, I get lost where I was. But there's the story where deity is performing some tapasya to get a child to kill the Adityas, and then so then Indra finds out about this and he comes and serves deity really, really well. And both of them had a malicious intent because deity wanted to kill all the Adityas. Indra wanted to kill the child in the womb. So they had this malicious intent. But Kashyapa, very intelligently, had engaged deity in devotional service, serving the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So her heart became purified. And because she was becoming purified, and Indra, he approached her with a malicious intent, but he served her, he also became purified. So they started to develop all these nice, wonderful Vaishnava qualities. So then Indra, he was looking for this fault in deity. And what happened is she went to bed one night and she hadn't rinsed her mouth after eating, so she was impure. And because she was impure, then Indra was able to enter through her mouth into her womb. And then he cut the child up First he cut into seven pieces, then he cut each piece into seven pieces. So a total of 49 pieces. And then the child came out. The child was born. And Indra came out along with the child. And Diti saw Indra there with the 49 maruts. And she said to him, "Tell me honestly, what's happened here?" And he said, "Oh, mother, I'm very sorry, but, you know, I entered your womb with this improper intention to kill your child." And you know, and he apologized to her. And Diti was, okay. She accepted that. And she forgave him. Because he was honest, and you know, and because she had become purified, and so she went away happy, and Indra went away happy. And we see here that these good qualities are, devotees take on the good qualities of Krishna by serving Krishna. And it's just like whenever you associate with, Prabhupada makes this point, you know, if you associate with a certain type of people, you take on those qualities. If you want to be, Prabhupada mentioned, if you want to become a stockbroker, you associate with stockbrokers, you take on those qualities. So by associating with Krishna, by associating with devotees, one takes on the qualities of Krishna. And we see that Krishna here is very, very compassionate to the devotees. And he never... So sometimes he'll speak sternly with the devotees, like when Brahma gave Hiranyakashipu those benedictions, and then the Lord, he warned Brahma, he said, "Just be careful about who you give benedictions to in the future. You know, you're creating a lot of trouble doing things like that." But it's not like, you know, I mean, Krishna's capacity to chastise and to punish someone is unlimited. But we don't see him do that. Rather, the material nature does that. And we see, you know, Krishna says in the Gita that, you know, that those demons are cast down into lower births. This is by the influence of material nature, to protect them from you know, the basically to protect them from themselves. So Krishna, as we see here and in many places throughout the Bhagavatam, he has a very, very compassionate nature, and he wants the best for the devotees. He wants to give them, you know, help them improve their situation. So he's making so many different arrangements whereby the devotees can actually advance in Krishna consciousness. And, you know, in devotional service, we experience this every day, how Krishna is making so many nice arrangements for us whereby so we can improve ourselves in devotional service, so we become more and more attached to Krishna. And if we are lucky enough and intelligent enough to take advantage of that, then we're going to progress very nicely. But if we make mistakes, even when we make mistakes, Krishna's still there for us. He doesn't turn away from us. It's only what happens is we turn away from Krishna by our desire and our endeavors to enjoy the material nature. We turn away from Krishna. But Krishna's still, it's just like when you come here before Radha Gokulananda, they're just standing there patiently waiting for us to surrender to them. They don't go away. You know, we might turn our head away. We might go and do some nonsense, but they don't go away. They're still waiting for us. And they'll continue to wait for us. This is the nature of Krishna. He's very tolerant and he's very merciful. And he's just waiting for us to surrender to him. Okay, so I'll finish it there. If there's any questions or comments at all. Srinivas Prabhu. But he didn't. He didn't really punish him.
He didn't punish him.
Because we see that Arjuna did that.
Good point.
And you know, like really, if you look at what happened to Ashwatthama, and it's a really good example of Krishna's compassion, because Ashwatthama killed sleeping children. A heinous crime. I mean, and the punishment of such a crime is that he should have been killed. But, you know, Krishna, by his arrangement, he basically said to Draupadi, "Well, what do you think?" And Draupadi's saying, "Oh no, but we can't kill him because he's the son of the guru." Krishna knew she was going to say that. You know, but he was trying, you know, it's like, I do a lot, well, not as much teaching as I used to, but I do a lot of teaching. And in so-called modern teaching, you have these different types of teaching. You have didactic, experiential, and interactive learning. So Krishna, and some people say, "Oh, but you know, this is all New Age teaching. You know, we should just, you know, do it like Krishna does. You know, sit down and do the Bhagavatam class type thing." But we see that Krishna is the master of experiential learning, because the whole Bhagavad Gita is just an example of experiential learning. Because what's he doing? He's putting Arjuna through all these different emotions. He's really churning Arjuna's emotions, getting him to get to the point where he actually experiences this feeling and he makes a commitment to go out in the battlefield and kill all his relatives. So the same with this pastime you bring up. He put Arjuna through the ringer. Arjuna just couldn't figure out what to do. You know, because he said, Arjuna was thinking he should have killed him. But then Draupadi is saying, but you can't do this. So finally Krishna says, well, actually, you can kill him just by cutting the top knot off his head. And he said, so he did that, and he sort of cut him on the face and different things like that. Because actually what happens is later on is Ashwatthama eventually becomes Vyasadeva. So we see that Krishna didn't kill him. Krishna was very compassionate upon him. And now Ashwatthama is in this situation, describes in one of the Puranas. He's now in this situation where he's in this material world. He's on the planet still, but he's living kind of like in disgrace. I'm not sure if it's actually really that, but no one sees him. He's traveling around, but no one sort of understands who he is. And he's kind of living an incognito life. But eventually he becomes sufficiently purified and he comes to the position of being Vyasadeva. So that means that he's going to become a great devotee of Krishna.
Yeah, Shivaram Maharaj says in his Navavraja Mahime that he's chanting the glories of Krishna in Vrindavan.
Yeah.
Ashwatthama.
Yeah. So Krishna was very compassionate upon him. He wasn't actually cruel with him at all. So Krishna's never cruel. Because Krishna understands what is the best thing for everyone according to their time, place and circumstance. He gives us that opportunity. So he's always compassionate upon the living, and he's always looking for the living entity's best interests and making arrangements. You know, in whatever situation you are in your life, he's making the perfect arrangement for you to surrender to him. Because Krishna's nature is that he has a particular quality for every single living entity. So he knows how to interact with you perfectly, just right for you and different from anyone else. Is there anything else at all? Prabhu?
Thank you. So Krishna expands as the calves and coward boys, but they're like all Vishnu forms. We also hear that the jivas are also expansions of Krishna, but obviously not in Vishnu tattva. How do we understand that? We're all also sort of expansions of Krishna.
So Krishna has different shaktis. He has external, internal, and marginal. So external is referring largely to material nature, which is basically inanimate. Then the marginal potency is the jiva. So it's still expansion of Krishna's energy, but the marginal potency is that situated between the external and the internal, has independence, some limited independence to act in this material world and to try to enjoy, etc. But not the supreme controller, although is expanded from the supreme controller. So we have this marginal potency, marginal independence, marginal capacity to control, very small. Yet, whereas we see the Vishnu tattvas, they're directly supreme, so directly supreme personality of Godhead. So all these forms, all these calves, all these cowherd boys, they're actually Krishna himself in Vishnu forms. But we're not like that. We don't have the potency to create, control the same as Krishna does. We're very limited. We have limited potency, but it's infinitesimal. And when you look at the word infinitesimal, you compare it to infinite. What is it called? I can't remember the word. It's a simple word, but it's just basically the volume, if you like. If you look at the size of infinite compared to infinitesimal, the difference is so vast as to almost be meaningless. It's just so vast. You know, we're so infinitesimal in comparison to Krishna. That it's almost a meaningless comparison. It's like in Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's commentary on this, he talks about, you know, holding a glowworm up to the sun. It has some illuminating potency, there's no doubt. And in the dark, you'll see it. But you hold the glowworm up to the sun and it's blinking its little thing. It's insignificant. It's nothing. So we do have that controlling potency. We do have that potency to create a little bit. But the thing is, we're not creating with our own energy. We're only borrowing Krishna's energy. We're not controlling with our own potency. We're only borrowing Krishna's potency. So every you know, everything, as Krishna says, is aham sabhasya prabhamata sarvam prabhatite. He says that everything comes from, all material and spiritual worlds emanate from me. And that's the difference, is the Vishnu forms, everything's coming from Vishnu. It's his potency. He has no source. That's what makes him God. We have a source. We're borrowing from him. Yeah, in the Bhagavad Gita it mentions something similar to that, but then we need to understand the concept of a chinta beta beta tattva, which is a very fundamental concept in Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy. Everything in this philosophy is a chinta beta beta tattva, simultaneously one, but different. Yes, we are nothing but Krishna, but we're not Krishna. It's just like Prabhupada, well actually Lord Brahma, Prabhupada's quoting here from Brahma Samhita. Lord Brahma has his verse... Shiram Yatada Didavikada Vishesha Yoga, that he's talking about Lord Shiva. How Lord Shiva is, he explains, he says, just as yogurt is a transformation of milk. It's nothing but milk. If you analyze it, that's all it is milk. But try to make yogurt into milk. Can't be done. So in the same way, Lord Shiva, he's just an expansion of Krishna, but he's not Krishna. So it's the same for the Jiva. We're nothing but Krishna's energy. But we're not Krishna. And even if you take all the jivas and you put them together, you add them up together, they still don't make Krishna because they're just a spark of his energy. But the Mayavadis have this concept that if everyone sort of, the Supreme, you know, expanded into all the jivas, and if you bring them all back together again, then you've got the Supreme again. You know, they just have these sort of twisted ideas, but it's not like that. They have a very limited concept of the nature of God. And a very limited concept of the nature of unlimited, because unlimited means that there is no beginning or end to it. There's no idea of how vast. You know, Krishna is unlimited. How can we with our small brain conceive of what is unlimited? Even this universe we're living in, you know, how can we conceive how big this universe is? But it has a finite size. But it's so big, we can't conceive of it. So, we need to, you know, it's very important for us to understand our limited nature in comparison to the supreme nature of Krishna. It's just so infinitesimally small, and he is so unlimitedly vast. And yet, and this is what tricked Brahma. He's kind of come to terms with the notion of God being unlimited and all powerful, this and this and this, you know, all these types of things. But then when he sees Krishna playing with the cowherd boys, and he's got a handful of yogurt that he's stolen from someone's plate and he's eating that, he can't deal with it. It just short circuits his brain. He can't understand it. It's just too much for him to because that's not God. God's, you know, just great and big and powerful and creates the universe, and when I'm floating around the lotus, I see him, you know, and he's just this inconceivably huge form, and the universes are coming out of the pores of his skin, and they're resting on the ocean, the causal ocean, and he enters into them and he expands. You know, that's what Brahma's conceiving. And then to think of this little boy, you know, stealing things from the plates of his friends as God, he just can't deal with that. And that's the problem the jivas have, is that they can't even get the idea of the greatness of God. You know, and then when we present, oh, he's a little blue cowherd boy, that's a bit too much for him.
Would it not be helpful for us to also worship a bigger form of the Lord, to develop that awe and reverence before we give up this awe and reverence, to at least develop it? Like, to, would it not be helpful worshipping if we had like massive deity of Mahavishnu or a big Virat Rup somewhere in one of these concentres, or and have some type of worship?
Prabhupada discusses that in a lecture. I think it might have been about Bhagavad Gita lecture he's talking about, and he said, but how are you going to worship that form? He says your whole cloth factory will be exhausted if you try to dress that form of Vishnu. So he very kindly agrees to come in a form, you know, this size, 3 foot tall, so we can dress him, we can ornament him. Because could you imagine if you had a form, like there's a temple in South India. I can't remember. Kumbhakarnam, I think it is. No, I was thinking of a different temple. I think it's in Kumbhakarnam. There's this. It's kind of interesting. It's a form of Trivikram. And you go into this temple. It doesn't look anything special. And you walk down I went there with Ramai Swami one time. And you walk down the passageway. And it's sort of going down. It's quite long and it's dark. And then down the end, you see these balls. They're about this big, hanging from the ceiling. This is some sort of Christmas decoration or something. I don't know what. And you get down there and you look up and there's this deity of Trivikram with his leg lifted up in the sky. And those balls, which are about this big, are his ankle bells. So it's a gigantic form. But how are we going to worship and dress that form every day? There's another place I went to down near the Sri Vaishnav Seat of Learning. I can't remember what it's called now. Huh? Not Sri Rangam, though. No, it's south from Bangalore. South from Bangalore. Anyhow, that's where the Seat of Learning is. And as we were coming back from there, we popped into another temple, and there's this deity which is probably about 8 meters tall, I would guess, maybe 9 meters tall. And they have to have all this scaffolding set up around the deity so they can dress the deity. You know, so it's very difficult, very impractical, makes it hard to do. So Krishna comes like this, in a form that we can worship. And he comes in the Shalagram Shila. The Shalagram Shila, especially get one that's the size of Amalaki fruit, you can close your hand over, is considered to be the ideal form of the deity to worship. Because what you can do is when you have a deity that size, is you can very quickly offer all the items of worship to the deity. You don't need great resources to do it, and anyone can do it. And the thing is, in our deity worship, Srila Prabhupada very clearly explains that we're not ready to worship Krishna in Vrindavan. Because that worship of Krishna in Vrindavan, that's Raganuga. And we're not on that stage. So the worship we do in ISKCON is the Aishwarya, you know, where we're worshipping this Lakshmi Narayan. So Krishna is here as Radha Gokulananda, but our approach to him is as Lakshmi Narayan. Therefore, you see, we're worshipping great opulence. We don't worship him as a cowherd boy in Vrindavan. Because of our conditioning, we'll commit offenses. So, you know, you don't see Krishna dressed up with all this opulence. You know, he dresses very beautifully, but in a simple way. So you won't see this kind of opulence in Vrindavan, all the gold and stuff like that, and dripping with jewelry and things. No, he's dressed, worshipped in a very simple way, but it's very beautiful. So, and especially for the living entity who's on the stage of Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, it's very important to approach this way, through this Aishwarya, because Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti means there's anartas, means we have impurities, so we have to worship through this stage to remove the anartas. And then when we get to the point where where the anartas are greatly diminished and it's more out of spontaneity than following the rules and regulations, then we can start to approach Radha and Krishna. So it is Radha Krishna, but the Aishwarya is there. It has to be there for us. For Krishna, it's not there. He just makes that arrangement, you know. And again, this is the act of his compassion upon us. And Prabhupada would explain that the Archa avatar, it means the mercy incarnation of Krishna. So out of his mercy, he's agreed to come here in marble and stone and metal and whatever, wood, so that we, the conditioned living entity, can interact with him. So everything he does, he makes so many arrangements out of compassion upon us. Us poor, conditioned living entities rotting here in this material world. He makes so many arrangements just so that we can interact with him, so we can perform devotional service, and so that we can go back to Godhead. Yeah. Okay, I'm not sure what time we're supposed to finish, but it must be getting close to prasadam. Thank you very much. Shri Prabhupada ki. Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki. Jainita Gopremandi.